I'm going to talk about suffering this morning. And I was hoping it was supposed to be cloudy and thundering and all of that. And I thought, well, that would be great. You might ask, well, why not talk about happiness or the wellspring of joy? And to me, happiness and suffering, joy and suffering, are two sides of the same coin. So this is the first of a two-part lecture, the one on suffering. So why talk about suffering? The Buddha, when asked, what do you teach? He said, I teach suffering, and I teach the release from suffering. Now, the Buddha's very first talk after his enlightenment was about the Four Noble Truths in the Eightfold Path, which are about suffering. Now, the First Noble Truth says that all people suffer. And the Buddha says that when he woke up in enlightenment, he saw that all people suffer. This wasn't a hypothesis or a theory. It was really something about human nature. And it reminds me of something that Emerson, the famous 19th century essayist, said. He said, all people live a life of quiet desperation. Quiet desperation. And so that's what we're going to talk about. That's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is, what's the cause of suffering? And the short answer usually is craving. But more broadly, it's what we call the three poisons in Buddhism. And it's craving, grasping, attachment, if you will. The second of the three poisons are things like anger, dislike, pushing away. And the third poison is ignorance or delusion. And so these are the causes of suffering. And then the third noble truth says, well, how can I get rid of suffering? And of course the answer is by getting rid of what causes suffering, or at least being able to work with it and control it. And then the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path, is actually a way to do that. Is how do you go out as an individual, etc., and release yourself from that form of suffering. It's interesting when you look at the image of the Buddha, and when they talk about how the Buddha saw himself, he wasn't the stoic Zen master. You know, how many pictures have we seen, you know, the Zen master in robes, you know, face like this, etc., you know, kind of frozen in presence, if that makes any sense, frozen in presence, etc. The Buddha always said, I'm a physician, I'm a healer. And it's interesting that the pattern of the Four Noble Truths actually is the formula that physicians in ancient China used to heal people. And so the first, they would ask, what's the illness? Secondly, they would say, what's the cause of that illness? Third, would they say, is there a solution? And fourth, they would say, well, how do we apply that solution to treating this individual of people? The idea of suffering is at the very core. Is at the very center of the Buddha's early teaching. And I want to look ahead a little bit, to the joy part, which is another lecture, to say that the path is a long one, and there are at least three major parts of it. And working with suffering really is just this early part, the early part of the path. And so we're going to kind of look at that. So when I think of suffering, I usually think of suffering as having three layers, and I think it's a useful way to look at it. And I think by the time, maybe in a half hour or less, when I'm finished talking about it, I think you see suffering in a different way than you may think about it at the present time. And that's good. What we're trying to do is get some distance and some release. The first layer, when I think about suffering, is the suffering right here, day to day, week to week, year to year. And sometimes it's called disease, dis with a hyphen, ease, disease. It's fretting, it's worry. The word in Sanskrit is dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, dukkha, and it's been translated as suffering. Suffering is kind of a strong word. When I hear the word suffering, I think of I'm hanging by my two thumbs, something like that. And in Buddhism, it means a whole range of things. And I think it helps really to think of suffering along a spectrum from really bad to not so bad, so we don't lump it all together and just worry, 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 right? And so let's look at the bad end. Your parents are sick or dying or have died. You found out you have cancer in less than 6 months to live. Now, that's something to worry about. And if we step back just a little bit, you've lost your job. You have a family. There's no one to support you. What are you going to do? Pretty bad. We go back a little bit. You've got a pretty secure job, but you hate the people you work with. Can't stand your boss. Your work is dull, and you got 30 years to go before retirement. And I think you can work your way, back further, where you married that big football star from high school, the big hunk, who now is kind of a big blob 20 years later, doesn't talk to you much but says, "Hun, can you get me another beer?" You know what I mean? Not too bad. You haven't lost your job. You're going to not end up in the street. And you can work your way back and back till you're just kind of bored. You're sitting there at night watching TV, just kind of bored with life. And so these are all kinds of worry, all kinds of fretting, if you will. And so suffering has all different kinds of form. And I think when we think of that suffering like that, it's important to separate it from pain, because pain and suffering are different. And understanding the difference really is the roadway to really working with suffering. Let's say it's dark at night. You wake up. You hear a drip. And the kitchen and the bathroom are over here someplace. The drip is coming from over here someplace. And you know that this is Minnesota, right? And so all kinds of things can happen. And you get up and you walk through the dark into the living room towards the drip. Your toe hits a big chair. Pain. And I think if you just think about it a minute and try to feel that pain, that toe crashing into the chair, I often what that feeling is. I mean, we all have that kind of feeling. But then we say, "Oh, woe is me. Alas, who left the chair out there?" "Oh, now I can't play golf. Why does this always happen to me?" In other words, suffering is kind of a narrative cap we put on the pain. Buddhas don't suffer suffering in that sense, but they certainly feel pain. I think of Devadatta, who was a very jealous cousin of the Buddha. He threw a stone at the Buddha once. He wanted to take over the Sangha, and he hurt the Buddha, and the Buddha felt pain. When the Buddha was 80 years old, the Buddha ate some spoiled boar meat and died, and had great pain as he died. But he had released himself basically from suffering. So there's a big difference between suffering and pain. When our parents die, for example, when we hear that we have cancer, when we lose our job, we have pain. We have pain. But our idea is not to have that narrative, etc., that suffering narrative, etc., that makes things worse and worse and worse. And as Emerson said, and as the Buddha said, this seems to be kind of a normal human trait. Every human being seems to have this capacity, if you will, for fretting and worrying and what we might call suffering, etc., in every culture we look at. But this is something the Buddha says that we basically can overcome. So that's kind of the base level, that first layer of suffering. But if we want to understand suffering, and we have to move up to another layer and kind of look at it a different way. And this second layer is what I call the socialization layer. When you're a little kid, your parents are always telling you how to behave and what to do, right? Your teachers are always telling you what to do. The books you read, etc., have morals. They're telling you basically how to behave and what a successful person is. So if you're sitting there playing with your Facebook thing and not doing your homework, your parents are saying, "Johnny, if you don't get going with your grades, you're not going to get into a good college, you're not going to get into a good job, You're not going to have a nice big house. If you don't take care of yourself and you let your health go, et cetera, you know, they're going to say, oh, you know, you're never going to find a companion and no one's going to hire you if you look that way, you know, on and on, if you will. And a lot of suffering on the first layer, basically, is not meeting the expectations of that narrative. Okay? Here you are, you're 40, approaching 50, whatever. You're never going to have that job. You're never going to live in that kind of house, etc. On and on. And you start saying, what's my fault? You know what I mean? And so you start having feelings of low self-esteem. You know what I mean? So a lot of our suffering on that lower level, basically, is not meeting those expectations. So one thing we can do in understanding suffering is really listening to the socialization layer. If you're a parent, you know, listen to what you tell your kids, etc. Listen to the teachers, etc. Or just pay attention around you about what kind of instructions are given. And these are ideals. And like all ideals, they're just ideals. And we never quite reach them, which is a source of suffering. Well, where does all that come from? And we can go beyond that to the third layer. And this is the layer we call worldviews, if you will. And every worldview or culture actually has different themes that separate one worldview or culture from another. In our Western view, particularly North America, we have the idea of the individual right, that we are individuals. But as an individual, we also have responsibilities. Okay? It's very important. We also tend to see the world as formed of separate things. So there are dogs and cats and bunnies and ducks and all that kind of thing like that, and they're all separate. We might think of the world also as a source of wealth, something we can reach into and use, etc., for ourselves. This is all part of our worldview, and for whatever reason, we tend to think that we're better than other people. But for whatever reason, we just seem to have that. It's part of our individualism, if you will. And it's these big, if you will, themes that kind of come down, filter down into our society, into the socialization process, so that where do you get this idea about if you do not do this, you will not get a big house? And we're talking about individual responsibility, but also individual rights. If I want to have a gun, I can have a gun. This is my private property. I can treat it any way I want, etc. And so it comes down to these big things. If I want to go out and cut the forest down, I can. That's what nature's for, if you will. Now, so these are big things that come down, and most of them live a life unaware of what they are. And what's really interesting in North America at the present time is that even though we share these big things, we interpret them in somewhat different ways. And so today we have blue cultures and red cultures. You know what I mean? And if you're red, you have this idea of individual responsibility. Why should the state pay for your health care? You're not taking care of yourself. So you can see how these things kind of ratchet down. Now, sometimes it's easier to understand, some of these major themes if we look at other cultures. Let's look at East Asia, China, during the period when Buddhism was formed. One of the major themes is how do I behave within my family? How do I behave within society? And what's really interesting, in India and to the West, one of the primary questions that was asked, what is the nature of reality? Okay? So they're really interested in kind of what we call metaphysical questions. We get to East Asia, and the major question is, how should I behave? How should I behave? And so it's quite a different way to go. How do I live within a family? How do I live as a member of society? And when they look at things around them, they see them as intertwined, if you will, the yin and the yang, etc. So all of this filters down these great themes that most people are unaware of, filters down to the socialization level. So if you're a little kid in that society, you're being told, Johnny, don't look at your Facebook. You're not being told, your Facebook, you're never going to get a big house, you're never going to be successful, but you're told how to be a good family member. You're being told how, basically, you should live in society, how you should teach nature. Now, all of that reminds me of something I read about a Chinese Zen master who had given a week-long retreat. And half the people in retreat were Westerners, half were traditional Asians. And at the end of the retreat, he talked to individuals one by one, and he said, well, how did it go? You know, how do you say, how did it go? And the Westerners said things like, you know, I started and I was so full of anxiety, and over the week I relaxed. I could really feel myself becoming calmer. Or you might say, you know, I came in full of anxiety and it just increased. You know, and I say that for those of you who've gone to a lot of retreats. You think when you go to a retreat and you close your eyes and you sit in a mat that somehow calmness descends. And when you first start, of course, the volcano erupts, right? And it's one of the first times in your life you've ever really looked at what's all there that you're trying not to look at, right? And so the Westerners said things, you know, about themselves. When he talked to the Asians, they said things like, I'm going to be a better daughter. I'm going to be a better son. See the difference? Etc. For me, this is liberating, if you will, to realize that even though we all, as human species beings, etc., share this propensity, if you want to call it that, or this idea of threat, of suffer, worry. You know, I mean, it just seems to be part of our evolutionary background. But to me, it's liberating to realize that what we worry about is different. You know, if I'm traditional Chinese, if I'm a typical North American, if I'm a Native American, and on and on. So while people suffer, they suffer for different reasons and about different things. And so what we suffer about, a typical Zen master who's raised in China or Japan may not quite understand what we're all about. So when we go to Dokusan and say, I've got all these problems, it takes a traditional Asian teacher a while to actually get acquainted, to really realize, what's going on over here. So there are cultural things. Now, is that all there is to suffering? That is these three layers, and I think that's very important. You have a choice in life always. You can just say, well, I'm just going to do the best I can and go from day to day. But if you're on the path, you want to open yourself up. And one of our problems is always that we don't see enough. We don't see enough. We don't look up. We don't look up. But we tend to live our life from hour to hour and day to day. So as far as the levels go, look up, see more, if you can. So is that all there is to suffering? There is more, etc., of course. And for those of us who are looking to Buddhism for advice and guidance, that maybe how to live our life, that cross-cultural borrowing can be a source of confusion and suffering unless we're very aware of what the problems are. When you borrow cross-culturally, there are two processes that you can become engaged in. Now, one is assimilation, where you just borrow things and you adjust them and change them into our Western way of looking. So on the East, of course, they have this idea of social solidarity. In the West, we have this idea of strong individualism, even narcissism, if you will. And so we take these ideas that are developed in one's culture, we bring them and transform them into our own culture. And to that extent, to what extent are we practicing Buddhism? Or are we just borrowing ideas? The other way, of course, is what we call accommodation. And that is where we understand as best we can what the intent was, what the context was. And then we adjust that, we bring that fully into our Western life. And this is one reason why the difference between assimilation and accommodation, that it oftentimes has taken Buddhism hundreds of years, basically, to mature in places like China, Korea, Japan. And I would say the same thing in the West, that we're still in this kind of early stage of assimilation, if you will. Well, part of the problem is, of course, that we borrow selectively. And we borrow things we're interested in, and we don't pay attention to things we're not interested in. And if you think, well, that's far-fetched, let me ask how many people, when you go up to see Tim in Dokusan, how many say, Tim, I'm worried about my karmic load, etc. You know, all this karmic bad stuff has been accumulating. I haven't been as good a person the last 20 years as I should. I'm kind of worried about it. Now, how many people have talked to Tim about that? How many people have talked about fretting about constant lives? You're being reborn and reborn and reborn. And, of course, at the very base of traditional Buddhism is this idea that a real suffering, and I haven't even mentioned that, real suffering is this constant rebirth called samsara, etc. You might think it's great to be reborn, but then you get older and you get stiff. And I can tell you all about that. And then you die, and it goes on and on and on. So how many people have talked to Tim about that? Or what about you're worried about where you're going to be reborn when you are reborn? And remember that there are traditionally six different places we can be reborn. We can be reborn as hungry ghosts, if you know anything about any of that. Then a hungry ghost has his big belly, etc., and really wants a lot of stuff, but has a little bit of throat, you know what I mean, and can't get enough stuff in, so it's consumed with greed. Or what about, you know, the hell realm, where you're being turned into spit, etc., and everyone around you is angry, etc. Or what about the Titan realm, which is, you know, kind of a lesser god, but Titans are so consumed with jealousy that they don't have time to think about enlightenment and nirvana and things like that. They just want things that other people have and they can't get. So how many people have gone to Tim and said, geez, I'm worried about being born in the hungry ghost realm, etc. Now, so there's a point there that we borrow selectively. And some of those ideas, samsara, karma, etc., rebirth, all those ideas are absolutely at the core basically, of original teaching. So we borrow selectively. Another problem is that we understand words differently. And I'll just give three examples. An example of anger, the example of self, an example of attachment, etc. We hear that one of the translations for one of the poisons, of course, is anger. You know what I mean? This is the second one, anger, etc. And you know you get angry about things. And you feel, well, I'm confused. There's something wrong. Am I supposed to be placid and accept all of this? You think of the kids in DeFore. You know what I mean? Just horrible existence, and you're angry, etc. Because we're individuals, etc., somebody slights us, and we get angry about that. And we read, well, one of the poisons is anger. And therefore I should shove all that aside, etc., and accommodate it. But that's not what anger means in traditional Buddhist society. Anger means hostile intention. Hostile intention. And if you know something about karma, you know that it revolves around intention. Intention. You can hurt somebody, but if it's not intentionally, you don't get a karmic load, if you will. So both the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh say it's fine to get angry, you know, about a personal insult or a social cause. You know, that's not the problem. But real anger, I mean, the Buddhist anger, is this intentional hostility, etc. So you can just see on that one example that if you don't understand, you get confused, and you can sit for 30 or 40 years. You know, with these confused ideas, and you know, you get nowhere. Right? If anyone, maybe creaky knees, if you will. Well, what about the idea of a self? And if you've been around Buddhism long enough, you hear them say there is no self. And you look around and you see everybody sitting here, and you say, oh, you know, that's kind of strange. And when you feel ideas of self come up, you feel, well, I'm doing something bad. But what the Buddha, they mean by the self in Buddhism, of course, is some kind of an essential self, a soul, what sometimes is called the Atman, if you will. It's an essential part of you. And the Buddha kept saying, look, look, look inside, look inside. Can you find that soul? Can you find that that essential thing that is a self, etc.? And his answer was no. And he argued because we think we're a self in that way, that this leads to things like craving and anger. Buddhism never says that we don't have a psychological self, etc. We certainly have wants, desires, love, hate, things like this. And we know from recent brain studies, etc., that these don't have a single location in our brain, but they arise independently as a mass. And we call all of that working together the self in shorthand. But Buddhism doesn't deny that we have a self in that sense. They also don't deny that we can have agency. Agency means things like I want, I say, etc. Certainly, this dependent arising, if you will, of what comes to be the self, etc., can have agency. It can have self-identity. We can have self-expression, etc. But what we don't have is we don't have the Atman, we don't have the soul, etc. And to misunderstand all of that, of course, can lead to confusion. And you can read all you want and you get confused. Much of Buddhism actually is about developing character, etc. And we read a lot about watering some seeds. Do you remember all this in classes? And starving other seeds. You starve the bad guys and you feed the good guys, such as loving kindness and compassion. And so a lot of our training basically is developing character, developing aspects of ourself. And if we think there is no self, etc., you know, every time that comes up, etc., and we think about that, and we want to push it aside when we should be focusing upon it, but understanding it correctly. Okay, the last thing I'm going to mention is attachment. And, of course, another definition for the second poison, the first poison, is attachment. And we think about craving, but it's just want, attachment, etc. So we can think, well, we shouldn't be kind of attached individuals. But in the West, because of our particular individualism, that one of our problems is learning how to form positive attachments with other individuals. And if you're a person who tends to, hide, if you will, personally, you know, you want to withdraw, you have trouble integrating well into society, the idea of don't form attachment, etc., seems like a welcoming understanding of the way you behave, when in reality that's not what it's about. And so it's quite a difference in the West compared to the East. The Dalai Lama said it took him a long, long time to understand what low self-esteem meant, because it was just not something that arose. It's not that they weren't aware of these, but these were just not the center, basically, of what they were concerned with. And so because we live in these different worldviews, we're individualistic, another group may be family-oriented, etc., that we have different psychological needs depending which society Buddhism actually spreads into. And that's part of accommodation. Etc. And so a good Buddhist psychologist today, and we have increasing numbers of Western psychologists with Buddhist training, etc., will tell you how to develop positive attachment as a Buddhist practitioner. Now, all of this, when you think about it, part of it makes you want to cry. You know what I mean? But part of it makes you want to laugh. And the crying part is they realize that it's part of our fundamental nature of human beings, etc., to fret, to have suffering, if you will. And as I mentioned, it's expressed in all kinds of different ways in different societies. It's just part of the way we are. And if we don't wake up to what that's about, etc., we live a life, etc., of fretting and worrying, if you will. I laugh. It's also a source for laughter, etc., because when you really understand it, you begin to see, well, you know, how it's such a cultural addition. You know what I mean? It's so culturally expressed. You know, how can we get enmeshed and caught, basically, in ideas like that? And once we realize that, we can control it to some extent, etc., you know, then we say, oh, you know, this is just really great. When I work with Ken McLeod, who is a Tibetan teacher, he had a formula for working with these problems. And it's based upon the five aggregates. If you know the idea of a human being as five parts in body, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness, etc. The way he kind of rearranged it was that form really is some kind of a sensory impression that comes at you, etc. And then everything else is what happens. So let's say that you have a job you prepare a big plan to renovate the business, etc. And you go and present your plan, and somebody says, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard, etc. Why did we ever hire you? You know, things like this, etc. And so when you hear those words, etc., that's the incoming sensory perception. The sensation, of course, is you don't realize it yet, but is the feeling, oh, I've been put down, etc. And if you're the type to blush, this is when you get all red. Okay, you get all red, etc. And then the perception part is you consciously are aware that, hey, I've been put down. And then on the formation part, etc., you decide, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to go to work and tell that person off. Or that person has powerful connections and I can't say a thing. So I'll probably get an ulcer because my stomach is going to chew away at me, etc. And then in consciousness, you actually make a choice and you decide to act. And what you do in your Buddhist training is you try to be alert to the nature of that perception, etc. So you feel suffering, you feel bad, you know something's come up, and you recognize it for what it is. And so rather than reacting to it, you try to understand and act in a more straightforward, less reactive way, etc. So we have a way, basically, to work with it. Now, you might ask, well, what can I do right now? You know, what can I do right now? And I think the best advice I've ever heard if you're trying to work with all this, is as you live your life, etc., live your life with love and compassion in your heart from day to day. And when you feel suffering come on, when you feel that come on, take on the suffering of the world. Don't think of it yourself. Take it on, if you will, and live your life that way. So that's all I have to say about suffering. Perhaps people have their individual stories about suffering that can enlighten us, or they have comments. Don't be shy. Okay, thank you.